Hi everybody, it's Friday, July 11th, 2025, and I'm our friend Ambassador Chas Freeman is back with us. Welcome back, Ambassador.
Glad to be with you, Nima.
Ambassador, I want to start with your article or your note on this Sino-American contention in the era of Western decline. And it's a... It has a lot, all the dimensions about the economy, about the political, geopolitical changes, and the somehow the competition that is going on between the United States and Iran, between the United States and China. What can you say about, if you were to describe the current situation between the United States and China, what are the crucial, what are the very important and very substantial issues to be mentioned?
Well, this morning I gave a talk at the University of Cambridge in London, in England, virtually by video, to a group of senior Chinese officials and business people who are rising in the system and are very likely to be the leaders of the future. It was a good opportunity to speak with them. And I must say, the dialogue that we had after I spoke confirmed what I had thought, which was that the Chinese are very bewildered by Donald Trump and the turn in American politics. They don't think it makes any sense in terms of American interests, still less their own or those of the world. And I agree with them about that. Basically, the United States, for reasons that have very little to do with international realities and a great deal to do with our own self-dissatisfaction, has chosen China as the enemy of choice. And the two political parties have aligned themselves together in lockstep on this issue. There's really no significant difference between them. And the Chinese, of course, in addition to being bewildered by this and puzzled, and have been trying to figure out how to talk to the Trump administration. And they've been not succeeded in figuring out how to do that. And a great deal of the problem is, in addition to Mr. Trump's mercurial personality, his erratic behavior, his tantrums, which you in Brazil have just experienced, his outburst at Lula, President Lula Silva, and his defense of Bolsonaro, which we discussed earlier in the week. In addition to this, he's now alienated the Japanese and South Koreans. He's caused the Australians to be ill at ease. And a great deal of this has to do not only with his personality, but with the total disorganization of the White House foreign policy apparatus. So, for example, he just sent a letter to Japan imposing unilateral sanctions on Japan, you know, basically giving up on the negotiation with Japan for a trade deal. I think he thinks this is a point of pressure on Japan that will cause Japan to capitulate, but no, it's actually enraged the Japanese. And the rage is all the greater because the White House actually published this insulting letter before it was delivered to the Japanese. So the first they saw of it was in the press. Now, this is no way to treat a friend or an ally. But it is really just a mark of the chaos that exists. The National Security Council, which was staffed to prevent this kind of mistake and coordinate the implementation of policy, basically can't do that anymore. The head of that is Marco Rubio, who's also the Secretary of State, the chief archivist of the United States, and the head of what remains of USAID. He's not able to do any of those jobs effectively, but the lack of coordination in the White House, you know, ultimately is Mr. Trump's fault. What we're seeing is confusion on a variety of issues. One that I know you probably want to talk about is the weapons supply to Ukraine. But we can also talk about the breakdown in the U.S.-Russian negotiations over the end of the war. The meeting between Prime Minister Netanyahu and Mr. Trump to basically compose terms of surrender to be delivered to Hamas. This is not a negotiation either. This is all peremptory, unilateral, and very ineffective. There's been no success to date with this approach. So I was speaking to the Chinese, and I basically said to them, look, there's nothing you can do about this. The problems are essentially lodged in Washington. And if I were you, I'd just sit back and watch this unfold, because the United States is making lots of mistakes. And if we really are your adversary, it's in your interest to let us keep going, making mistakes, not to stop us, even if you could. And I also said, and I believe this, that there's been enough of a rift in U.S. relations with China, so that basically the only answer is to wait. Wait for new leadership on both sides. Neither Donald Trump nor Xi Jinping is immortal. Both countries are undergoing a lot of change domestically as well as internationally in their relations. Wait. There will come a time when we will rediscover the fact that we need each other. And it is an interesting opportunity to talk to a future group of Chinese leaders. They seem to be appreciative. The discussion itself is off the record, but I did put the text of my remarks up on my website, which is Chaz Freeman, FREEMAN.net. Chaz Freeman, all one word. And of course, I sent you a copy, so you could react.
Later on, I can put it in the description of this video. Anybody can access the article.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Ambassador, you talk with the Chinese, and do you, in their opinion, the main difference between the United States, in the opinion that they have uttered to you, the main difference comes from the geopolitical issues. The main difference comes from the way that China is growing economically. How do they see the United States? How do they find it? The main problem with the United States is what field is the most important field for them?
Well, I can't speak for them. I think the problems are largely psychological. That is to say, around 1870, the United States became the largest economy on the planet. Now, that position has now been taken by China, by most measures. If you want to measure it in terms of exchange rates, the U.S. is still larger than China, but the U.S. dollar is frankly overvalued, as our trade deficits demonstrate. So if you use purchasing power parity as a comparison, the Chinese economy is about one-third larger than the U.S. economy. And China produces about one-third of the world's goods. It's also the largest consumer society on the planet in purchasing power terms, not in nominal exchange rate terms. Psychologically, the United States is having a difficulty to adjusting to not being number one. There's an ideological element. There are a lot of very people who have a great deal of animus toward the Communist Party. Not that they understand the Communist Party at all, they don't. But they think they do because they have in their minds the model that the Soviet Communist Party provided during the Cold War. So we have a challenge to our national pride, our face in Chinese terms, Mianzi in Chinese. We have a challenge to our international relationships because now China is an alternative to the United States. And so I don't know what Brazil is going to do in reaction to Mr. Trump's tirades against your president, I think this is probably a very good thing for your president, because he was pretty unpopular before. Now he has a boost as a defender of Brazilian sovereignty. You know, I would expect that there would be retribution. Perhaps Brazil will buy Airbus instead of Boeing and do other things of that sort. But in any event, it wasn't a wise move and wasn't well calculated. And it was rude and unseemly.
What's so strange that he's trying to interfere in the domestic policy of Brazil in favor of one candidate and going against the sitting president of Brazil?
Yeah, no, you wonder why he thought this would do anything but infuriate Brazilians. And, or, you know, why treating the Japanese in such a rude fashion, as I described, would do anything but infuriate the Japanese. I mean, we are now seeing for the first time in my memory, in 80 years, we're seeing a serious debate begin in Japan about whether to keep American bases, whether to reach out to China instead of the United States, what to do. Now there's an election in the upper house in Japan in about a week. So Mr. Trump has just ensured that the U.S.-Japan alliance is in a state of fragility. And the U.S.-Brazilian relationship, which was not good, is now terrible. So what was the point? I don't know.
Ambassador, when it comes to Ukraine, you mentioned that how do you find Europe today and the way that they want to deal with the issue in Ukraine? Because as time goes by, we see that Russian attack, I don't know if you heard about the Russian attack. It's unbelievable the way that they're attacking. It's so big, and one of the biggest attacks that we've seen so far in the more than 3 years.
Right.
And here is what the German Chancellor is talking about. Let me play it for you.
I have two messages. The one goes to Moscow and to President Putin. The message is quite simple. We will not give up. And dear friends, my second message goes to Washington, D.C. and to President Donald Trump. Stay with us and stay with the Europeans. We are on the same page, and we are looking for a stable political order in this world. We are both, the Americans and the Europeans, are part of with us. Stay with us on this side.
Well, this is a dilemma for Chancellor Merz. You know, I think there's clear division in Europe now. We just had a vote of confidence in the European Parliament, and von der Leyen survived. But what the vote revealed, and what commentary about her deputy, Kallas, the Estonian anti-Russian firebrand, revealed, is that Europe is divided on this question. Chancellor Merz may not have majority support in Germany for the policy that he just reiterated. Europeans talk big, but what do they do? And how can they claim any credibility when they agonize over a single death in Ukraine at the hands of the Russians, but they excuse and actively assist the Israeli murder of thousands of people, tens of thousands of people. So I think Europe has very little credibility, and I don't think Mr. Putin will be impressed by that statement, because he knows that Ukraine is losing the war. He's winning. And if there is no diplomatic process offered, he will continue on a military course. And this brings me to the breakdown of the U.S. talks with Russia. Basically, Mr. Trump has offered Putin nothing. He's called for a ceasefire. he's not addressed any of the points of concern to Russia, the question of European security architecture, the question that Chancellor Merz raised when he talked about the solidarity with the United States. What is the stable order that should prevail in Europe? At the moment, it is anything but stable. Europe is having a very serious war on its territory. The neutrality of Ukraine, is that addressed by Mr. Trump? No. What about the rights of Russians and other minorities in Ukraine in accordance with the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe guidelines? Nothing. And so Mr. Trump says, keeps saying to Vladimir Putin, Mr. Putin, stop the war. But he doesn't give Mr. Putin any reason to stop the war. You know, you don't go to war for nothing, and you don't stop it for nothing. So there is no European strategy on this to say that, you know, we're with you as long as it takes, or whatever the phrasing is, as Joe Biden said, doesn't mean very much. In the end, what happens on the battlefield matters more than what is said in places like Rome. And so I think there's a certain unrealism here. And is Mr. Trump with the Europeans on this issue? I don't think so. He may be very annoyed with Vladimir Putin for not capitulating to his demand for a ceasefire. And he may have had a temper tantrum and offered weapons to Ukraine. My understanding is that all that is actually going to be delivered is 10 missiles, Patriot recharges, not anything effective. As you said, the scale of the Russian attacks is now such that these are just a drop in the bucket. They won't do anything. Finally, even if there were more weapons provided, Ukraine doesn't have the manpower to use them effectively against the Russians. And so I think what Mr. Merz is proposing is essentially an eventual suicide for Ukraine and a problem for Germany in terms of relations with Russia that his successors will have to deal with.
What's going on in Ukraine? I think nobody's talking about Ukrainian people. They're getting, they're somehow capturing, hunting young people on streets and everywhere they can find them and send them to the battlefield to get killed, to get murdered by this military machine. And these people, when in Europe they're talking about Ukrainians, they're talking about the Ukraine, do they really consider these people who have no training, who don't know how to fight, that they're sending them to get killed? How is that going to be related to democracy and what they're talking about?
Well, it has no relationship at all to anything. It's an act of desperation on the part of the Ukrainian government. There have been reports denied in Kyiv that, in fact, the Ukrainian government plans to move to Western Ukraine, which is the heartland of the ultranationalists who control the Kyiv government. But Kyiv is now very much under attack. And you have these press gangs picking up people on the street and giving them no training to speak of and sending them off to the front. The desertion rates are very high now in the Ukrainian army. They milled away as much as they fight. Now, of course, there's still some very tough, competent soldiers in the Ukrainian army, and they're battle-hardened. But there are fewer and fewer of them. And the Russians, on the air part, are expanding their forces, not contracting them. There is a real serious offensive underway now, just on the not just in the east, but in the south as well, Zaporizhia. And I think if this goes on, Mr. Putin will, in fact, set his sights on Odessa, which he has not, officially claimed, even though it is historically a Russian city. That would deprive Ukraine of its Black Sea coast and make it a landlocked country like Bolivia or Hungary or somewhere like that. There's a lot at stake here, and simply repeating that we'll do more of the same is not going to produce a different result.
Ambassador, when we were talking about the Biden administration, nobody knew who's running the show in the Biden administration. We were talking about Jake Sullivan, Anthony Blinken, those days of Victoria Nuland, deciding about everything. But right now in the United States, with the new administration, with the Trump administration, even it seems that we're getting to the same point. Nobody knows who's making these decisions. Here is what Donald Trump said and how he's aware of what's going on in Ukraine.
Hey, you said that you were not sure who ordered the munitions halted to Ukraine. Have you since been able to figure that out?
Well, I haven't thought about it because we're looking at Ukraine right now and munitions, but I have not gone into it.
What does it say that such a big decision could be made inside your government without you knowing?
I would know. If a decision was made, I will know. I'll be the first to know. In fact, most likely I'd give the order, but I haven't done that yet.
So who ordered the pause last week?
I don't know. Why don't you tell me?
I should think that's a question.
Now, this is exactly what I was talking about. Lack of policy coordination. This is the job of a National Security Council. That is to make sure that the left hand and the right hand know what each of them are doing. So here you have a case where the people in the Pentagon very clearly, having heard Donald Trump on numerous occasions say that he opposed weapons for Ukraine, looked at a situation when we had almost run out, the United States had almost run out of certain weapons because we have been engaged in a proxy war in Ukraine and supporting Israel in its genocide and aggression against its neighbors and Iran. We don't have the weapons. So the logical decision is to do what they did, which is triage. So, okay, we can't supply everybody with what they need. We'll give Israel priority. Ukraine won't get any weapons. And I think that's pretty much what happened. What's different about this is such a decision would never in the past have been made without the participation of the Department of State, the National Security Council, perhaps others in the government. And in this case, there was no coordination. And that's what Mr. Trump is reflecting. And, you know, this raises a real question. When he was in business, he took six companies bankrupt. Is he doing the same thing to the United States because of a managerial incompetence and bad judgment? No judgment about the quality of the people who help him manage what he's trying to manage. You know, I think there's now a real question about that. He doesn't seem to know what's going on in his own government. On the other hand, nobody, basically everybody's afraid to make a decision without his personal approval. Well, the U.S. government is a very large organization. And it deals, it deals with a great number of issues. One man can't manage all of that. He has to delegate. But to whom does he delegate? The people that Mr. Trump put in charge don't have any qualifications for the jobs they have. The Secretary of Defense is a talking head from Fox News. The head of the CIA is a congressional member of Congress, a politician. The head of the National Intelligence Department is herself a former politician and with no experience in intelligence. The Secretary of State is somebody who was once opposed to Donald Trump, who's clearly very ambitious, wants to run for president in 2028, but has no foreign policy experience outside the Western Hemisphere, and that only in relation to Cuban causes because of his Cuban heritage. So is this administration staffed to conduct the United States as a major power? I think the answer is beginning to be clear. It is not.
Do you, when it comes to the situation with Russia, we had the meeting between Rubio and Lavrov, and no sign of Witkoff being part of this and being talked about. Do you feel that we are a step forward, or we are at the same? What's going on? Why does he need, Donald Trump need to send Rubio? Is he changing his strategy, his policy with Russia, or he's trying to formalize something maybe behind the scene? They've reached some sort of agreement that we are not aware of.
I don't think there's any agreement. I think, in effect, Vladimir Putin has written off Donald Trump for the time being anyway. It's not possible to do business with him. He's offering nothing. If he agreed to something, you could not rely on his keeping his word. He changes his mind. He abandons commitments he's made. He does not enforce agreements that he has negotiated. He acts unilaterally without regard to the interests of allies, friends, partners, or, for that matter, adversaries. So I don't know what's behind this, but I do know that we now have three different channels of communication on Ukraine. One is Stephen Witkoff, who's a real estate mogul from New York, a crony of the president's, with no diplomatic experience. One is General Kellogg, who was appointed by Donald Trump as the envoy for Ukrainian matters, and who has been dealing with Ukraine and more recently with Belarus. And there's now Marco Rubio, who's in a different channel altogether. So who is in charge? The answer is nobody. And of course, the good thing about this is that we are talking to the Russians, even if in a confused manner, because the Biden administration wouldn't talk to them, which was a huge mistake. At least we're talking to the relevant parties, even if in the case of the Palestinians, only indirectly through the good offices of Qatar and the Egyptians. But at least we're talking to the Russians. At least we're talking to the Palestinians. On the other hand, what we're saying doesn't seem to make much sense to any of them. As I said, the Russians have an agenda which they're going to follow until it's addressed. And we won't address it. So they just keep rolling on the battlefield. Hamas is not prepared to surrender, exile itself, give up its weapons, abandon Palestinian self-determination, walk out on the people of Gaza who are suffering so terribly at the hands of the United States and Israel, because the United States is now part of the whole apparatus which was set up eventually to replace the United Nations. The United Nations had an effective food and medical supply chain going in Gaza. The so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, run by Israel and the United States, is basically a means of laying out bait for Hamas and then killing people who are so hungry they come to take the bait. It's a slaughterhouse. It's not a feeding station that we're operating. So what does all this add up to? If any other country were doing this, we would condemn them. But we don't. We have gone beyond that. And as I said to Glenn Deason the other day, there's a really incredible thing here, and that is Europeans, and I go back to Mr. Meretz, Chancellor Merz and others, they basically say we've got orders from the United States. And like the German army and the in the Nazi era, they say, well, we're just following orders. You know, we're just following orders. Well, where's their conscience? Where's their independence of mind? Where's their policy? How do they propose to organize affairs on their own continent so that they have peace and stability? The United States doesn't have a proposal for that. They don't either. The Russians may have, but we'll never know unless we talk to them about it.
Donald Trump was asked about a two-state solution, and he transferred it to Netanyahu, and Netanyahu went on and didn't give anything about the two-state solution. He mentioned that he talked about the Abraham Accords and all of that. And we know that they're planning to send more than 2 million people to the southern part of Gaza, to somewhere in Rafah. And it's going to be a prison for all these Palestinians to be gathered there, to be punished, to be moved to other countries. Ambassador, you've seen a lot of things during the years. And do you think is that possible, the way that they're dreaming about these things?
No, they have been consistent. This is just the reductio ad absurdum, the extreme form of what Zionism has always been about. And that is the eviction of the Palestinians, the erasure of the Palestinian presence in Palestine. And in this case, they're going to organize, well, in a sense, Gaza has always been a concentration camp. There were 2.3 million people there. There evidently 400,000 or so have died, because now they're only 1.9 million. But they are now to be concentrated in a very small area in what are called a humanitarian city, meaning a concentration camp. And why are they there? They're there as a holding pattern until they can be expelled. So this is basically, you know, and then the Israelis are talking about voluntary departure. This is like telling Jews in Berlin, you should depart voluntarily for Auschwitz. Please get on the train. And, you know, by the way, the Americans are here and they'll give you a drink of water so you can survive the trip to Auschwitz. And then once you're at Auschwitz, well, you know, Auschwitz on the Mediterranean is what Gaza has been turned into. So this is unspeakable, really. And the fact that the world does nothing, and I say the world, my own country is helping do this, which is a disgrace. Europeans are not resisting it. In fact, on the contrary, what they are doing is persecuting anybody who condemns genocide. And they silence them, they arrest them, they declare them to be terrorists, even as they aid and abet the actual genocide. This is only 80 years since the Holocaust, when Europeans carried out a genocide. I thought that one of the few unquestionably good results of World War II was that we had banned repetition of this kind of thing. But here we are, four generations later, doing it again. It's really quite incredible.
Do you feel that Netanyahu wants something big from Donald Trump in terms of what's going on between Israel and Iran?
Yes, he wants the help of the United States to arrange the surrender and disarmament or murder of Hamas and the Palestinians in Gaza. He wants the United States to look the other way or even support the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, which, by the way, the campaign there is in high gear. He would like the United States eventually to join Israel in attacking Iran again. He wants the United States to arrange the surrender of Syria to Israel. And of course, now there's talk about Netanyahu and Sarah meeting in, perhaps in Washington, somewhere else maybe, in the fall, in September. Maybe at the United Nations, I don't know. Anyway, and I think I think the difficulties that the authorities in Damascus are having with integrating the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, or the Kurds, into the National Army, probably those difficulties have an Israeli element to them too. And because the Israelis have been heavily involved with the Kurds in Iraq, in Turkey, in Iran, and in Syria. And the objective the Israelis have always had with respect to Syria is to break it up and put it in fragments and control it. And incidentally, this is very similar to what the vice president of the European Union, Kaja Kallas, the Estonian deputy to Ursula von der Leyen, advocates with regard to Russia. She wants to break it up into little countries so it can be divided and it won't be a threat. You know, it can be manipulated. This is a kind of thinking that really does not deserve much of a hearing. But I think Mr. Netanyahu has a hearing from Donald Trump, and he's able to manipulate him. And he is manipulating him. And Donald Trump doesn't really know what he's doing in this case, I hope. Because if he does know what he's doing, then he is a totally indecent human being.
What's going on, Ambassador, with Donald Trump and Netanyahu is somehow complicated because Donald Trump went to the Middle East. He didn't go to Israel. J.D. Vance was supposed to go there, and he canceled his trip to Israel. And the Israeli prime minister went to the United States, coming to the United States for the third time in 6 months. Is that really the relationship between the two, the prime minister of Israel and Donald Trump, is that good? Or they're somehow pretending that it's in a good shape, but behind the scenes something else is going on?
Well, every president who's dealt with Benjamin Netanyahu has ended up despising him, detesting him. I don't think the relationship between those two men is good. But Mr. Trump depends, his election to office was dependent on donations from wealthy Zionists who support Mr. Netanyahu and the genocide. And Mr. Trump has a domestic political problem because it's becoming apparent to his base, meaning his own constituents, people in rural America, people of working class, that he has basically sold out their interests. They're going to have less access to health care. They're going to have a higher rate of inflation from the tariffs. They're going to have no sudden surge in manufacturing jobs as promised. You're seeing the backlash. So parts of the deportation program that Stephen Miller devised are now having to be abandoned because we can't work our farms without immigrant labor, and much of that labor is illegal or unregistered. Hotels can't function without these people. They're the ones who clean the rooms and wash the dishes and so forth. The American economy is heavily dependent on this labor, and it cannot be expelled without huge damage. There are not Americans lined up to take jobs as dishwashers in hotels or to cut lawns and to mow lawns in people's houses. And so he's got a problem. His base is increasingly disaffected. So he's made, I think, a deliberate decision to hold on to his donors. And this actually explains to me why he suddenly decided to disappear the Epstein files, this pederast probably connected with the Israeli intelligence service, Mossad, who had a list of wealthy people to whom he offered sexual pleasures, as he himself performed pederasty, that is, going after young girls. That list has disappeared. Why? Because a lot of Donald Trump's donors are on that list. And when he says, I don't want the list to come out, if there is a list, there is a list, by the way, but I don't want that list to come out because it could hurt a lot of people. What he means is it could hurt some of his donors and that they've asked him not to release it. And so you get the contortions that the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, has gone through to say, well, and Kash Patel, the head of the FBI, both of whom made a big thing before the Trump administration came into office about the Epstein files, now saying, well, there aren't any Epstein files. Well, this is a lie. And you can understand why the lie is being spoken. So, Mr. Trump, as I think I predicted shortly after his election, is beginning to alienate his own constituency. That is, he provides the antidote to his own misdeeds.
Ambassador, here is what CNN reported about a voice file in 2024 when Donald Trump was talking about China and Russia. Here is what he said.
The Putin said, if you go in to Ukraine, we're going to bomb the shit out of Moscow. I'm telling you, I have no choice. The public wants it. The public. So he goes like, I don't believe you. He said, no way. And I said, way. And then he goes like, I don't believe you. But the truth is, he believed me 10%. And I told you this. He believed me 10%. Then I'm with President Xi of China. But I said the same thing to him. I said, you know, if you go into Taiwan, I'm going to bomb the shit out of Beijing. He thought I was crazy. He said, Beijing, you're going to bomb me. I said, I have no choice. I got to bomb him. We're going to bomb Beijing. And he didn't believe me either, except 10%. And 10% is what you need. In fact, 5% would have been okay too. And we never had a problem. We would have never had a problem.
Do you find someone that is bragging about what he desires? And
well, first of all, I think this is entirely fictitious. He's making this up. I doubt he ever said anything of that sort. If he did, it was totally irresponsible. And in both cases, you know, bombing the Capitol is not something that you want to do because you get bombed back. You'd lose Washington very quickly and much of the rest of the country. So this is an empty threat, and I don't think it was ever uttered. But it is consistent with Mr. Trump's desire to portray himself as a tough guy, somebody who knows how to stand up to other people. But he doesn't seem to know how to stand up to other people. And so far, his foreign policy is a disaster. Whether it's with, you know, he just raised tariffs on Canada. For what? For an imaginary fentanyl problem. So I think, you know, there's a real question about his mental health at this point. Does he have a firm grip on reality? It doesn't appear so. Does he remember correctly what he did? Maybe not. He's always played fast and loose with the truth. He believes, a lot of impossible things. This falls into that pattern. But it is completely irresponsible. If you were either Russian or Chinese and you heard this, you would conclude that he's not anyone you want to deal with.
For the case of Brazil and Canada, these are, I would argue, these are two countries that don't participate in these geopolitical chaos that that is happening. They're trying to do their job. They're trying to be there at their comfort zone and doing the business they have. Even with these countries, they're not immune to what Donald Trump is doing. It's unbelievable.
Geopolitically, it makes no sense. Why would you take countries that are not against you and turn them against you? Same is true of Mexico, by the way, a country where I studied at the university years ago and for which I have a fond feeling. There's quite a tangled history between the United States and Mexico. And when the Mexicans hear politicians in the United States talking about bombing Mexico, their reaction is not favorable. And I see, you know, it's interesting. Mexico attended the Rio de Janeiro meetings of the BRICS, whereas before it had kept its distance. Yeah. Mr. Trump is uniting everybody in concern about him and concern about my country. This is not in the United States' interest. It's not in anybody's interest, really. It's not even in the interest of China and Russia. It's a threat to world peace.
Before the presidential election, he, in more than four interviews that I followed him, he was talking about why do we need to have Iran and Russia as our enemy. We can do business with them. We can reduce the sanctions. We can find some sort of political solution for what's going on between the two, the United States and on one side and Russia and Iran on the other side. But it's all gone. It's all gone. Nothing of that sort of attitude that he was talking about. It seems that Donald Trump is someone else. Is not the guy who was talking about Russia and Iran before coming to power. And it comes to Brazil, Canada, and all these countries. It's not just about these two countries that they have substantial differences with them.
Well, I remember years ago when Idi Amin, do you remember Idi Amin? He was the chief of government and state in Uganda. And he was a cannibal, among other things. And he eventually was thrown out and took refuge in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. He's not been heard from since. But he too was very erratic. You know, he would say one thing in the morning, another in the afternoon. And there was actually a theory that Idi Amin was actually eight guys sharing one suit. And they would just put on the suit, and you never know what they're going to say from one minute to the next. Well, Mr. Trump is not quite at that level yet, but he's getting there. So if there are, maybe there are Trump impersonators who are sharing Mr. Trump's suits and coming out and saying one thing one minute and another thing the next minute. In this regard, I would like to recommend to you, there's a guy in Chongqing, China, who imitates Mr. Trump perfectly. So I invite you to Google Chinese Trump impersonator, and you'll see this guy. And my favorite incident is where he's eating hot pot, or guo in Chinese, with a friend. And he says, "This hot pot's all mine. You can't have any of it." But he does it in the total Donald Trump voice and manner. You know, all this is very ironic because Mr. Trump, in his first term and in the Make America Great Again movement, claimed that the world was laughing at us in the United States. Well, they weren't. Now they are, I think, very often. They hear the word Donald Trump and they start to laugh. Because he's not serious in the French sense of the word, un homme sérieux, somebody, you know, you can talk to, who makes sense, is reliable. No, this is not Donald Trump. So he's not Idi Amin either. But you have to wonder, maybe there's just one suit and many men sharing it.
Ambassador, before wrapping up, we had the interview of the president of Iran, Pezeshkian, and later on we had the comments of Iranian Foreign Minister Araghchi. I can say that from the tone that I'm hearing from them, they want to talk with the United States. They want to find a political solution for what's going on between Iran and the United States. Do you see in the aftermath of the attacks anything changing in terms of the attitude of the United States and Donald Trump and his administration?
No, not really, unfortunately. I mean, I think the United States has been taken prisoner by Israel on this issue. And the Israelis suffered terribly during the war. There was a huge amount of damage done to military and intelligence facilities. Residential areas were destroyed. There was a lot of property damage. This is the first time that Israel has experienced this on a national level. Of course, Hezbollah did something similar on a more limited scale in the north of Israel in response to the Israeli genocide in Gaza. But the Israeli government continues to conceal the facts, the extent of the damage from its own population. Military censorship remains in effect. And most Israelis are convinced Israel won the war, which I don't think is correct. I think Iran showed that it could destroy Israel. And there are people in Iran who, now I understand, who argue that Iran made a big mistake by accepting Donald Trump's ceasefire proposal. They should have kept going and finished the job. Anyway, I think Israel is still intent on pursuing absolute security for itself, which means absolute insecurity for everybody else. And the United States, unfortunately, is in lockstep with Israel. I don't see that changing in the near term. However, having said that, we do have elections in the United States. There is public opinion, and it registers in the elections. And there are really quite striking figures now about disapproval of Israel and the American support for Israel from the American public. Whereas a few years ago, they were pro-Israeli, anti-Palestinian, that has turned around. So I think the trend is against Israel, we just have to. And at the moment, I don't think Israel has the capacity to carry out any kind of attack on Iran. There is another element here, however, and that is I think Iran may be about to be involved in the U.S.-China hostility, because I think the Chinese, for very sound reasons, will want to resupply Iranian air defenses and help Iran and probably Iraq after U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, also with air defenses. Iran and Russia have a strategic partnership, but they are historic enemies. I think the Iranians are very likely turning to China for this kind of support. And I think from the point of view of Chinese foreign policy, it would make sense for China to provide it. So this means that yet another issue that is, are you friendly with China or not, is introduced in the U.S.-Iran equation. But I thought Araghchi and Pezeshkian made it quite clear that while they want to talk with the United States and work something out, they don't see this as a ripe moment for doing that. This is not the time. The preconditions do not exist. I think the Iranian position has been quite clear. We will talk if you make it clear that you will not attack us again. And the United States does not seem willing to provide such a guarantee.
Yeah, unfortunately. Thank you so much, Ambassador, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Have a great weekend, Nima.
Thank you.